Was there a role or a moment that really enabled you to, quote, break in to acting?
I think my entree into it was Paul Mazursky taking a risk and hiring me in Harry and Tonto with Art Carney. I was 21. I'd just gotten off a year on the road with Godspell, and, you know, where you play a clown for 3,000-seat houses and things. So I was, but I went up, I met him in New York after the tour, and he was willing to say, okay, you know, I want you. But I'd never done a movie before. I mean, you know, there's always got to be somebody at some point who's going to put their neck out and say, you, I'll let you.
So you were in the film, and then it was a question of how you'd be reacted to and how the film would be reacted to. Was there a point where you knew that you were going to be successful in it and it would lead to another role?
I think once the movie came out, and, you know, my role was a supporting role, but it was clearly a featured role in the piece. So I went to Los Angeles when it opened, thinking I would just take advantage of the opportunity because Hollywood is where they hire, although I had gotten Harry and Tonto in New York. But in Los Angeles, people were meeting me and casting directors, and they'd say, and I was there right when it opened. So they said, oh, yes, we just saw you at a screening. Oh, you're wonderful. You know, and so I was there, I was being seen, and I was where the work was. So I kind of knew then that, and it seemed to be Paul Mazursky had just had Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. It was a big commercial hit. It seemed like it was a good project.
The first role I saw you in was Girlfriends, which is a movie that I really love. How did you get hooked up with that?
I had a manager in New York named Bill Tresh, who had Sissy Spacek had been with him at one point, Carol Kane, a lot of really, his taste and his vision is very unique. Chris Walken he has now, Tom Berenger, Eric Roberts. And Bill had sent me up to meet Claudia Weill. You know, it was literally like he was the manager and he said, there's a woman casting this movie. Now, at the time, it was supposed to be an hour film for public television about two girls who are roommates and their relationship, and at the end, one gets married. Period. End of movie. And I met her, and I auditioned with her a few times, and she did some improvisations and some, you know, and had me read a monologue and a few scenes. And then I was told I got the part. But everybody I knew, all my girlfriends in New York, had gone up for the movie. Gilda Radner had gone up for it. A lot of other friends, that Carol Kane had gone up. You know, I mean, the people that I know that people would know who they are, but it seemed like whenever there's a part, it's like everybody goes for that part because there aren't that many roles. So
one of the things I really noticed about you in the film is that you seem to be as attractive as you were feeling at the time in the movie, which I thought was wonderful since most people are like that. Most people have their days where they look kind of ordinary and dull and awkward, and there are days where they're
glowing,
really lit.
Yeah.
And you went through both of those in the film, depending on how you were feeling about yourself. Was that intentional?
Yes, because there's, I mean, for example, there was some scenes in the country at when, Ann. When Annie gets married, she has a country house with her husband, Martin. And we had one weekend in the country to shoot all the scenes in the country that happened during the course of the film. So when we went to the country, we spent 2 or 3 days there. And in the movie, there are scenes in the beginning after she's gotten married and I'm kind of out at the house and kind of real low-key. And she's pregnant and she's talking about going to school and I think I'm feeling bad because she's going to have a baby and now she's going to go to school and she's married and she has everything and that's not fair. And I'm feeling real bad. And so we did those scenes. And then in the same day or next day, we do the scene at the end where I'm coming after my photography show, and I'm coming out there, and I'm all dressed up, and I have a little duck and a bottle of tequila, and looking good and feeling good, and I have a boyfriend, and that's good. So, and they were all just putting on, you know, it's for the scene, purposely dressing yourself up or dressing yourself down.
What would it do to your face to change the way it's going to look? Is how much of it is you controlling your facial muscles, and how much is makeup that someone applies for?
Mostly,
you?
It's your thoughts. You know, if you're thinking, it's going to come off, especially with the camera. I mean, I think something on stage, you've got to do more with your face or more with your posture or more. But on film, it's your thoughts. I mean, if I'm in the part where I'm not supposed to be feeling too good about myself and feeling jealous and envious and all of that, you know, we did with my hair because in Girlfriends, my hair was real full and real shaggy. And the fact that I had naturally curly hair was kind of a blessing because I could pin the long parts up and make it look like a short haircut, a short curly haircut, and then let it down. And I literally, there were days when I was pinning it up, pulling it down, fluffing it out, just to go from scene to scene. So it was like the acting approach to each scene in terms of...
How does that knowledge of how your own face changes with the way you're feeling about yourself apply to your real life?
I think it's similar. I mean, say in doing a role, you go, "Oh, I shouldn't be feeling that good here," or "This is what I'm going through." So you know you're going to feel a certain way, therefore look a certain way. I mean, there are times, you know, in real life, you get this great outfit and you try it on in the store and you look terrific, and you go home and you put it on and it's looks terrible because you're just not feeling up to it that day. And then the next day you put it on, great. And you say, "Well, how come it looked so bad on me yesterday and it looks so great on me today?" And it's the same thing.
Are roles like Girlfriends hard to find where you're in that you were playing someone who I'd consider to be a very real kind of person? It's I felt like I knew the character, and I know a lot of women who felt that way. And it's not very frequent, I think, in a movie where you feel that sense of kinship with the person.
Like
on
a
the
marriage
screen.
With the part. I agree. I think that Girlfriends is a milestone in my career, definitely. And Susan Weinblatt, the character I played, was somebody that, you know, is like a soulmate. There were differences. You know, it's funny because people said to me, "You're just like that, Mel. You know, you played yourself. You didn't even have to act." You know, I got that a lot. But I remember struggling in the script when I was doing it, going, "Well, I would do this much, but I wouldn't do that, or I wouldn't say that, but Susan does." So it's funny in a way because I think it's almost harder to play a role that's closer to you because it's hitting home more, it's touching more bases, and your separation about what's you and what's the character gets to be a much subtler thing.
So saying to you, "Gee, you really didn't even have to act," isn't really a compliment for you as an actress, is it?
Or it's the highest compliment.
Because it looks so natural.
Right, because usually when you get up in front of a camera, when anybody can get in front, you become so self-conscious, you're so aware, things are going on, this and that, and to try and be as much at ease and as natural as sometimes comes off on film is actually, when you think about it, one of the hardest things to achieve.
In your role in Girlfriends, you're attractive but not glamorous, and it seems to me that in a lot of movies, the female lead has to be really glamorous looking. I haven't seen you in any glamour roles. Could you play then, do you think?
I think so. I think that, you know, it's like, first and foremost, I'm an actor. So whatever the part is, you know, you can dress your looks up or dress them down. And I've mostly had to dress them down. But I think that in a, you know, people like Farrah Fawcett and Susan Anton, there are those Bo Derek, you know, where people, these are glamour pusses. I mean, they are beautiful women. But there also are the movie stars like Goldie Hawn and Jill Clayburgh and Diane Keaton, which are attractive, but I wouldn't say necessarily glamorous. So it seems to be, you know, I think a bit of both, probably.
Is there a kind of role where you know you shouldn't bother applying for, or one that you feel is perfectly suited to you?
Well, sometimes, you know, like, you know, you might hear, "Okay, there's two women's roles in this movie." And you go, "Oh, well, good. How old?" "Well, you know, mid, late 20s, 30s, you know." "Oh, great. Well, could I do it?" "Well, no, it's a Midwestern WASP, blah, blah, blah," whatever. You know, and you go, "Oh, well, no, I wouldn't be right for it." Or, you know, there's certain ones, "No, they want a tall blonde," and, "Oh, okay." I mean, sometimes you know they're not looking for, or they're looking for, so.
Do you have a resume or like a portfolio that describes you and the kinds of types that you're capable of playing?
No, not at this point. You know, as a beginning actor, sure, you go around with your little book of pictures and you have all your summer theater jobs or whatever, what you've done. But people, I think, from Girlfriends and before do know.
How are you described in the industry? Are there types that people are described in terms of?
They'll sometimes say kooky or offbeat. That was like a good one. Sometimes, you know, heavy or thin. You know, it goes like that. Pretty. You know, there'll be model types. They'll be like that. I think the real trick is to be able to kind of go from one to the other and hopefully not get typed down.
You had said that you've mostly had to play your looks down in the roles that you've had, and an excellent example of that was your role in Playing for Time.
No hair would tend to play looks down.
No hair, half starving to death, abused, in a state of complete physical disarray. How did you get that role, and did you have to think twice about it at all?
Yeah, I did. I went up for that. I was in New York and had just done two theater pieces. My first Broadway show, The Goodbye People, with Herschel Bernardi and Ron Rifkin, which lasted one night on Broadway. And then a play at the Actors Studio that Ellen Burstyn directed, that an actress, Catelyn Adams, starred in. And I had done that, so I'd had two pieces of good theater, and then I went up for it in the fall and met the producers in New York at a mobile home, like uptown on a construction site, where they were the producers of some TV movie and about a construction worker and a girl. I don't know. I don't remember the name of it. But I met them in this mobile home, and the producer, Linda Yellen, knew my work and, you know, said, "Oh, Melanie, I love doing Girlfriends," and talked on and on. And she said, "Now, the role we have is somebody who has a very sympathetic quality on screen, very vulnerable, somebody very kind of innocent, so that the audience immediately feels a connection and likes this girl. And then the girl slowly begins to change." You know, they said it's the one character in the entire piece that really goes from A to Z. Everybody else kind of stays where they are. But this one changes. And, you know, she said it's a role where you would show just a normal, nice girl and how she could have completely changed from this experience.
You want to describe the change your character goes through?
Well, the girl is, you know, young French girl and has lost her boyfriend, has lost her parents. Lost meaning at this point she doesn't know where they are. And meets Fania Fenelon, the French cabaret singer, on a train from a prison, and they're on their way to Auschwitz. And so she's very innocent and young and was, you know, was just going to get married and doesn't, you know, knows Fania's singing and is a fan, you know. And what happens is that they are in the work camps for a year and then in the women's orchestra. And in order to survive, she begins to not be, you know, not share food, try and get more food, go with the capos, the prisoners who are in charge of prisoners, do sexual favors with them or with guards in order to get more clothes or warmer clothes or better shoes or shoelaces or food. And apparently a lot of women were doing that. And, you know, who's to judge about morality when, you know, it's survival? And so that was the kind of role.
Did you have to find a place in yourself that was accepting of her behavior in order to play that role?
Yes, I think so. You know, I could understand the change easily. You know, you go, "My God, what if I was in that kind of situation? What would I do?" And at that point, when you could be shot at any moment or you could drop dead at any moment, you know, why not? You don't even know if you're going to get out of there, so.
Just about every Jewish family in America has relatives who were killed in the concentration camps during the war. And it's, of course, an incredibly sensitive, delicate issue for every Jewish family. What kinds of research did you want to do for it, and were there any personal experiences that you brought with you to the role?
Well, I had a strong Jewish upbringing. I'd, you know, been bas mitzvahed and confirmed and had 11 years of Hebrew school and, you know, was really raised. My father is from Israel and my grandparents and aunts and uncles are there. So I really have grown up with a nationalistic sense of and a pride of being a Jewish woman in the country. And I did have to think twice when I got the part, but I had felt a strong, in my immediate family, relatives that had died in the camps, but I did have, you know, the pride of being Jewish and that background and a strong obligation to the people and to the background. And I felt that it was more important to do the part and to do the role than to not do it. Because, you know, the story of the Holocaust and what happened, you know, people today, there's some people that say it never existed. You know, and that kind of, or it's a line in a history book for these little kids, or a little paragraph. People don't know, and children today don't know. And television is like the strongest medium, so it that's kind of, you know, was a background to it.
Did you talk to your parents about what it was like for them to watch you on TV in a concentration camp? I imagine that must have been a very crazy experience for them, very, very painful.
Well, when I told my mother, you know, she said, I don't know how I can watch. She said, I don't know how I'll be able to watch you. But I know they did. But I'm sure it must have been very difficult. They saw me with no hair. I came home on Thanksgiving with 6 days' growth on my head. And I, you know, I walked in, hi, I'm here. You know, it was like, yank off the hat. Let me see you. What do you look like?
Is that a sacrifice for an actress to make, to shave your head?
Well, I think it's pretty strong. You know, the part that came with the part. If you were playing a Jew in the movie, you had to shave your head. And I kept saying, can't we wear bald caps? Isn't there anything you can do? And they said, no, you'd be able to see it. And plus, we'll only do it once, and then your hair will grow in. And, you know, it's like a man's hair growth, that stubble. You can't make that up. You can't put little stubble on somebody's bald cap or something. You know, they said they need to see it. And, you know, it was torturous. It took me 10 days to decide whether or not to do it because of the head shaving, because of the kind of piece it was. And, you know, it was a big thing. But I ultimately felt, well, to work with Vanessa Redgrave, who's a brilliant actress, to do a piece on television that Arthur Miller wrote, you know, it seemed to have such class all the way around that it was too good to not do.
It ended up being an incredibly controversial movie because Fania Fenelon, on whose life the movie was based, was outraged at the way her character was portrayed and was really outraged about the whole movie. She wanted to be a consultant to it and felt that she was treated very shabbily by the people involved with the movie who didn't want to hear from her. She was, of course, outraged that Vanessa Redgrave, who has very anti-Zionist attitudes, was playing the part of herself, a Jewish victim, in the concentration camps. Did you take sides in the controversy?
Well, I had my own feelings about it, which didn't want me to do the part. But obviously, because of, you know, my Jewishness and where Vanessa stands with her politics. But really, you know, I really had to examine everything. And I thought, ultimately, the story of what happened is more important than any mistakes anybody's made here in terms of putting this on. TV's the biggest medium. The story should be told again. And I'm going to do it. Because that's the, you know, on the broader scope, that should be seen again. And if I have an opportunity to be a part of that, good.
Did that controversy come between the actors and actresses?
No, because there are a lot of actresses in the movie that made up the orchestra, and many of them were Jewish, too. I just kind of had one role that was in the limelight. But they all felt the same way. They all thought that, you know, what happened was too important and really backed doing the project. You know, I sometimes feel people say, well, there's so many movies on the Holocaust. We had The Wall and The Holocaust and this, and people say, why do they keep doing them? But not that they should only do that, but it's important that they keep doing them, you know, every 5 or 10 years, because there's always new crops coming along, new people, and they should see it.
Did the role on the spending time in the set of a concentration camp haunt you at all? Because, I don't know, you probably have this too, but I think most people who grew up in the post-World War II period have World War II war dreams that are like stock images in nightmares. And to actually be in it, even though it's just a set, might have, I think, really exaggerated that imagery.
It was very difficult to, you know, be there for 5 weeks and keep trying to be a part of the recreation of that time. Very difficult. I think that, you know, we would always, in between takes and things, make jokes and try and laugh. I mean, but there became a level of, not hysteria, but a real desperation in trying to laugh and, you know, just to, like, relieve the tension that we had to pull together for the filming.
Yeah.
And I know the first week, I had gone down to 104 pounds for this part. And I'm 5'5½", you know, so I'm fairly average size. So 104 was pretty thin. And at the end of the first week, I was up to 112. And I was shocked. I mean, I got on a scale in one of the hotels. I said, how did I get to be 112? I dieted down. I've only been here 6 days. And I gained 8 pounds. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I had gone down at 100. When I went down to the shoot, I was 110, and I had lost 6. And here I was 2 pounds heavier than what I was. And I thought, what happened? And then I realized that all my first week of shooting were scenes in the beginning with Fania, with Vanessa and I, where in every scene I had to say, Fania, I'm so hungry, or I'm so hungry, Fania. Can I have some margarine, or what are we going to do? When are we going to eat? I, like, every day I had to say that over and over again. So I realized that at lunch, when we would break for lunch, I would eat for like 3 people, and then at dinner I would go out and eat these big steaks and spend a lot of money on meals. And I realized I probably subconsciously thought I was starving all week because I was talking about how hungry I was. And here I had literally packed it away.
So did you have to diet?
Well, I all of a sudden caught myself and went, okay, just have a salad at lunch and then a nice meal at night and that, do it that way. And yeah, and then I went back.
Melanie Mayron is my guest, if you're just joining us, and we're talking about her roles in Playing for Time. She was the star of Girlfriends, and she's opening in the film Missing, where she plays the role of Terry Simon. You want to tell us a little bit about your role in Missing?
Yeah, Missing is I'll tell kind of a capsule of the story to fit my role in. A young man named Charles Horman and his wife Joyce Horman were living in Santiago, Chile, They've been in Chile from like 72 to 73 for about a year, 4 months. And they had lived in an apartment in New York City before that, in an apartment building where it was a brownstone and each floor has 2 apartments. And there was a girl named Terry Simon who lived on their floor. And they and Terry had gotten to be close friends for years. Terry would, you know, on Friday night, if she didn't have a date, she'd go over to Charlie and Joyce's and they'd all hang out or whatever. And she was also friendly with Charles' parents who lived in New York. When Charlie and Joyce moved to Santiago, Terry hadn't seen them. I played Terry Simon. And after 15 months of not seeing them, she had had a month's vacation and she wanted to go to Machu Picchu in Peru and go to Bolivia. And they said, well, since you're coming this far, you might as well come another 3,000 miles and see us. And so she did. And during her 10-day stay with Charlie and Joyce, Allende's government was overthrown. There was a coup, and she was stranded in the country, and Charlie disappeared. And she helped Joyce look for him. And then his father, Ed Horman, who Jack Lemmon plays in the movie, Sissy Spacek played Joyce, the wife, came down, and they all tried to find Charlie. And that's, in a sense, the film.
The State Department has issued, I believe, a 3-page memo denying that they tried to cover up or that they had anything to do with Horman's being missing and his eventual death. They're denying that the film is true. And the film's veracity is a very controversial issue right now. I believe before the film starts, there's a prologue saying that this is all based on real events, that the characters are all real. Do you question at all the truthfulness of the film, or do you think that it's told the way it was? You've met all the characters.
I have learned from the people that went through it, from getting to know Ed Horman and his wife Elizabeth and Joyce Horman, the wife of Charlie, and Terry, and what their experience was, and reading the book The Execution of Charles Horman that Thomas Hauser wrote on documentating the entire thing. What Costa shows in the movie is 2 hours, which is 6 weeks put down into 2 hours, of their search for Charlie. And the facts in that are all true. So that you see the movie and you know these facts and you see how it was handled, the search and looking for him. And you draw conclusions based on that. Now, the State Department can say one thing, the conclusions you draw from seeing the movie can be something else, but then you go, well, who's right? What's on the screen is what the Hormans went through. And it's, you know, so you just have to kind of put it together.
The film was shot in Mexico. Why was Mexico chosen?
They did it in Mexico City because Santiago, Chile is a big Spanish-speaking city, so they can't go and shoot the movie in Detroit, you know, I mean, because you're going to see English everywhere. So Mexico City was the closest big Spanish-speaking city to the States, and that's why they went there.
Costa Gavras is known for making very controversial films. His other films include Z and State of Siege. Was there ever any fear around the set that if any American officials or any other officials found out what the movie was about and what its point of view was, that it would be disrupted in any way?
I don't know if it was. There didn't seem to be that. It basically seemed to be we were a movie crew on location in Mexico City. And there wasn't even talk of, oh my gosh, if anybody finds out. The government knew about this case for 8.5 years, and there was a book out about it, so it didn't seem like to have a movie being made. We didn't hear anything, at least, anyway, about officials and paranoia.
Costa Gavras seems to do films about subjects that he feels very deeply about politically. I doubt that the auditions entail the actors and actresses also agreeing politically with him or feeling that this issue is one of their causes. But was there any, as part of his directorial efforts on the set, any time where he'd sit down and talk politics and describe it?
Never. It's always been to him, I mean, even at the end when I said, Costa, what is your viewpoint? Like some of us said, you know, because it is his, if there's a political viewpoint, it's his. It's not the actors. The actors are hired to do the roles. And, you know, you can agree or disagree, but it's the director's viewpoint. And he said, no, I'm telling their story. You know, this is their story. And he said it's also a love story in a lot of ways between this man with set political right-wing conservative ideals and this young woman, his daughter-in-law, who could be, you know, was before, as Vietnam was ending, late hippie kind of free spirit, you know, this woman who married a son, and here they are down. They can't stay in America. They had to go travel and get into this trouble. And Costa centered it kind of on their drama. His, you know, political filmmaking was in the background. They had to create a city that was under siege. I mean, a city with military takeover. So there always had to be tanks and soldiers and things like that in the background of the scenes because that was how the city was at that time. But he never got into it. Never, even after.
Were your politics changed at all by the making of the movie?
I think I was affected in the sense that there's a line in the story where the American ambassador in Santiago says to Jack Lemmon, he said, let's face it, Mr. Horman, if you hadn't been personally involved in this, you would just be sitting at home reading about this in the newspaper, you know, and going, yeah, that's too bad. And that line, I mean, it hit home so much because, you know, you hear about the apathetic Americans or you hear that a lot of people don't go out and vote. And I think really what you're moved to feel at the end of the picture, aside from being emotionally swept up by it, is that, gee, if I'm unhappy with something, I should do something about it. I should vote or I should be responsible for who's elected, as they should be responsible for me if I'm in trouble. You know, but I think that you really get a feeling of responsibility. And if that's, you know, not just sitting in your armchair reading the newspaper and saying, too bad, and going off to dance class, you know, whatever it would be.
Could you play a role where you really disagreed with the point of view of the script?
I've been having a harder time with that. I've been having a harder time with that. I think maybe when I was starting to work, you know, 8-9 years ago in parts, that it was just a role. You know, it was anything to kind of get your foot in the door and get up there. But now, I don't think so. I think I have to essentially get behind the idea.
Having had a role in this movie that the State Department has issued a memo on, do you have any fears that there might be any blacklisting directed against you and other actors in the movie?
No, I don't think so. I think one of the wonderful things about this particular movie, you know, a lot of people have said, well, it's against the government, it's anti-American, it's this and it's that. And that's taking it, say, face value, literally. Actually, the movie was made in America. if the movies can point a finger at the government, it's the only country that can do that. So, you know, we talk about land of the free, home of the brave, and freedom of speech, and that is true. You know, we can do that in America, and that, more than anything else, speaks for the beauty of the film. And in that sense, I would say it's the most pro-American. I really don't think that there would be any trouble with that.
Do you and your other friends in film ever wonder about or worry about the possibility of another blacklist? I've spoken to some people who are like on the Hollywood 10 and stuff, and I always wonder if they or if actors today think that anything like that could happen again.
I think, I don't know. I mean, I know right now Ed Asner is having some problems with the fact that he gave $25,000, and I just heard 2 days ago that he's had threats to his life and that now he has to walk around with a bodyguard, and he said he was going to lay low. So I guess it's spooky because actors are in the public limelight, and if they use their position to be spokespeople for causes, it can be tricky. I mean, you have to either say, yes, you're going to do that, or do it through your work. And that's a choice that people have to make.
You've been good friends with Sissy Spacek for a number of years, and this is the first film where you actually worked together. I wonder if that was difficult at all. I know, like, for me as an interviewer, it's sometimes very difficult to interview friends of mine because it's an almost conflict of roles that you have to go through there. And you know a friend so well, it's hard to distance yourself and become the interviewer. Was it hard for you to act with a very close friend?
Well, so in your particular instance, it would be difficult because you know them so well and you've got to step back and be objective. If you're acting, if you're playing friends, you can use it.
Uh-huh.
You know, so if I was playing an interviewer, you know, if somebody else, if I had to hate her or be a villain to her, it would be difficult, but it would be the role. But in this instance, we were able to use the friendship, you know, use it in a positive way.
Is there ever any conflicts with your good friends who are also actresses when you're interested in getting the same role or working on the same film? There are so few, it seems, good roles for women that your friends who are also good women actresses are probably going for the same stuff.
Yeah, we're always, it's always seems like I'll walk in a room and there'll be four or five close girlfriends, and here we all are. You know, it's like always the same group. Or if they're not all in the room, we'll speak on the phone, and yeah, I went in on that Wednesday. Oh, well, I'm going tomorrow. You know, like we're all going up for the part. That is true, but I think I've gotten to the point where I know that everybody, you know, their path is laid out for them. And if I respect them, if I couldn't get it, I'd be thrilled that they got it. At least I know that maybe I'll get a free meal out of it or something, you know. But I think it's really true. You can't, everybody's so different, you know, similar but different. And it's the director or the producers who pick the quality they want. Because if you're all good, it's what they're looking for, you know, and that's really it.
Does it seem to you that there aren't a lot of good roles for women? I don't know if you'd even agree with that statement.
Yeah, I would. It's even, you know, SAG did a study on it, and it is. There are less. I think women are either, they're playing hookers or they're playing, I don't know, wives. They're either playing the little woman or the whore, period. And it's rare that there are going to be other roles than that. I mean, we do have our leading lady roles, but they're creating it for themselves. Jane Fonda's producing her roles and finding things that she wants to play and making those roles. Goldie Hawn put Private Benjamin together, which I thought was a pretty feminist film in the farcical situation. But, you know, it did have a good statement about it that a woman can take care of herself. But she put that together, and Barbara Streisand is now putting her projects together. And many, you know, these top women that aren't finding that they don't want to play the little woman and they don't want to play the hooker. They want to play intelligent, smart, thinking people.
There was a Philadelphia preview of Missing. It was a couple of months ago at least, and I think it was the first preview in the country. I know you weren't here for it, but what are the purposes of those previews? I had some friends who attended, and they had to fill out a questionnaire. Some of them were called at home for their feedback on the movie. It seemed like their feedback was going to be taken very seriously. But what are the people looking for? Who's behind it? Anyways, is it the director who organizes it, or the
producers?
No,
I think it's the studio's marketing section, it's one of the most important things about a film is selling the film. And if it's not sold right, if it's not advertised properly, you know, the advertising is what gets people in to see a picture. And a lot of films sometimes aren't handled right. And beautiful movies go right down the tubes because either the title wasn't good or the advertising stayed on a thriller aspect when it was a story of the heart and people went, oh, I don't want to see that. And they, you know, where a different part of the film was, you know, shown and exploited and it made it look like another film. So I think what they were trying to do with the sneak preview is get a good cross-section, pick a city where a lot of different people would be at the theater and follow up with interviews and see how they felt 2 months in advance of an opening anywhere. So that if people in general had a gripe about, if you know, there were a lot of people that all had an opinion about one aspect of the film or this, it could give the producers and the director a more objective way of looking at it. You know, when they put a movie together, they've seen it so many times that you can't see it anymore. You know, you put it together and you go, well, gosh, I hope it comes off the way I wanted, but I'm so close to it, I can't see it. And that's what they're trying to get, some objective feedback.
You're going to be getting a lot of publicity for this film, and I guess you have to start thinking about how you want to manage your image, because I guess you have to manage your image as much as you, like, you know, manage your money or manage the rest of your life. Are there things that you've decided you will or won't do for the press or publicity shots or anything like that?
Well, you know, it seems what they'll try, you know, what people will offer or what, you know, I think I'm trying to basically stay to a quality of work and a particular level in my choices. There's always going to be, you know, there are few roles like Girlfriends and like Missing. There are few projects like that. So I think the thing that I have to maintain, say, in how I'm projected to the people, which is from what choices I make and the work that I do, is basically that the projects say something, you know, that they say something. There's so many things that say nothing. There's so many scripts that say, Melanie, there's this part, and I'll read the script, and I'll go, so what? What is it? What's it about? What's it saying? Nothing. I don't want to do that.
Have you ever made a wrong choice where the script didn't look so good, but somehow the film was great, and you were sorry you hadn't done it?
You know, not really. Not yet. The times when I've had a gut reaction that it wasn't good, or I shouldn't do this, or what, you know, why should I do this now when I've done this already? I really haven't so far.
Mm-hmm.
There are things that I've wanted to get that I haven't gotten that I went, ooh, I wish I'd gotten that role. You know, I mean, there's always that too. That's the flip side.
Is there a director you'd most like to work with?
I think I'd like to work with, gee, there are a lot of them. Hal Ashby and Milos Forman.
What was Costa Garvis like as a director?
Fabulous. He's, first of all, one of the most handsome men I've ever seen. But more than that, he would know. He was always like doing, there was always a duality. He always had the background life, what I was talking about before, about the soldiers and that whole bigger-than-life creation, and then the stuff between the actors. But he gave you thoughts. He gave you motivation. There's a scene where I get arrested in the movie. Just to give you an example, I was on this big square and they were shooting where Charlie leaves me just for a second to go buy a newspaper. And while he's buying the newspaper, some soldiers come and start leading me off. Well, they did that over and over and over again because they were getting John and I in the same shot. It was this long dolly shot across a block. And then Costa came up to me and he said, okay, Mel, now we have a closer lens, you know, so we're going to be closer on your face. So he said, now what I want, you know, he doesn't see you, you know, so you're going like, we see like, help, get me out of here, look at me, they're taking me, stop them, stop them. And he said, but of course, it's all in your eyes. And then he went, okay, we shoot. And he ran away from me. And I'm standing there like, oh, thanks, Costa. Great. But what he did was give the thoughts, the specific thoughts. So all you have to do is, you know, emotionally, of course, put yourself there, you know, and do that preparation. But then with those thoughts, it comes right out. So it was wonderful because, and he didn't do that all the way through, but at particular moments, he would illustrate what he wanted by the thoughts. which is a great way to do it.
So you start thinking that way, and it shows up.
Well, what it was specific. He was giving you a specific, you know, what he thinks you would be thinking now. And, you know, that's rare, I think, that directors get that specific with the actor.
You had studied with Lee Strasberg, I think, who recently died. What kinds of clues did he give you about how to get into a character?
Lee, just what I was talking about now, about specificity. When I met Costa, Costa knew Lee and had observed Lee at the Actors Studio. So the fact that he was directing by giving thoughts, or he can't do the acting work for you, but he could kind of guide you along those same lines. And Lee was always, you know, talking about not being general, but being specific. If you know exactly what you're doing, you know, the richer, it will be that much richer because it's that specific.
Do you believe that you have to locate an actor in your own emotional past and or draw on similar traumas in your life to communicate?
Yeah, it's all choice. That particular, the method way of working is how you choose. It's basically linking the character and yourself emotionally, so that if you haven't if you're a mother and you haven't had an experience where you lost your child, or you play a mother and you've never had a child, so you don't know what it's like to be a mother, but you've had a dog. You know, well, you could. I mean, it sounds like I'm talking in the silliest or the simplest way, but you could substitute those feelings of what you feel for your dog or your cat as a parallel to, in a script, what. Do you know what I mean? That's the closest you have to draw on, but that's specific. And if the mother loses her baby in some scene and, you know, you have lost a dog or a cat, it's that, or you could substitute it as a lover or a mother or father or whatever, but it is getting specific.
We've talked about a number of your roles in Girlfriends, Playing for Time, Missing, Harry and Tano. What's next for you? Do you have your next role, or are you going to be shopping for it now?
Well, I don't have one that like I've been hired to do, but I have been writing. The actress I mentioned before, Catelyn Adams, who was in The Jazz Singer and The Jerk, she and I have formed a writing partnership and have written two films for CBS already, two TV movies. Neither of them have been made, but one is waiting to be made. It's kind of on a shelf and hoping for the right time. And this other one that we've developed, we also worked on with Charlie Haid, an actor who's on Hill Street Blues. And the three of us have been working on this project that has roles for all three of us in it. And it's for CBS. We've done the first draft, and one of the reasons I'm going back to California is to start working on the rewrite of it. But that would be a script where I've written a role for myself. So in some way, by hook or by crook, I'm trying to take hold and motivate the work, too.
Great. I really wish you luck, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.